When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest, Taylor Swift's Messy Maximalism Edition. It's Wednesday, April 24th, 2024. On today's show, Taylor Swift has stuffed her latest record, Tortured Poets Department, the anthology, with 31 tracks. An embarrassment of riches, or just kind of an embarrassment? Critics are interestingly divided. We discuss with one of our favorite ones, Slate's own Carl Wilson. And then Fallout is an iconic video game, dates back to the 90s. It's now a TV series on Amazon Prime. It stars Ella Purnell as an underground vault dweller in a post-nuclear future who must return to the surface to rescue a loved one. And finally, Becca Rothfeld, the book critic for The Washington Post, has produced a stunning collection of essays. All Things Are Too Small, Essays in Praise of Excess, is really a remarkable book and is being greeted as one. We are delighted to have her on our podcast to discuss. Joining me today is Julia Turner of the USC Annenberg School of Journalism, where you're a fellow. Is that right? A fellow?
I'm a senior fellow, Steve. Please.
Fellow.
A jolly good fellow.
That seems awfully gendered in this day and age, I just would like to say. Anyway, senior fellow Julia Turner is with us. Of course, there's Dana Stevens to my right, the film critic at Slate. Hey, Dana.
Hello, hello.
All right, let's make a show.
You left your typewriter at my apartment, straight from the Tortured Poets Department. I think some things I never say, like who uses typewriter.
Well, the Tortured Poets Department anthology is Taylor Swift's 11th studio album. A few notable things right off the bat. It's stuffed, some say overstuffed, with 31 tracks.
I laughed in your face and said, you're not Dylan Thomas, I'm not Patti Smith. This ain't the Chelsea Hotel, we're modern idiots.
Comes very close on the heels of her world-dominating tour and the movie of the tour. It continues, of course, her coy game of peekaboo by which the world's most famous woman gives us glimpses of her personal life. The title, it should be said, refers to two things, as I understand it, her six-year romance with the English actor Joe Alwyn. A lot of the songs also refer snappishly back to a two-week affair or so with Mattie Healy, the lead singer of the 1975, who I think ghosted her. Is that correct? Anyway, joining us to discuss is Carl Wilson, Slate's music critic. Carl, it is, as always, a delight to have you on our show. Welcome back.
So glad to be here.
Carl, I think it's fair to say that this album has been greeted with a degree of ambivalence. I'm curious where you come out on it as a record.
I am also curious about where I come out on it as a record. As you mentioned, there are 31 songs here. I think I still have a certain degree of PTSD from the experience on Thursday night of spending hours making notes and listening to an hour-long 16-track album, and then at 2 in the morning, suddenly having 15 more songs appear, which, like, real hardcore Swifties were kind of prepared for, because she'd been dropping hints about double albums that I had not paid particular attention to. And so there's that double-sidedness of the text, which also happened with her last album, Midnights. There was the 3 a.m. edition in which, you know, a dozen or so bonus tracks appeared. So we should have been ready. But, you know, overall, there's been this barrage of Taylor Swift for everyone to deal with in the past couple of years. You know, you mentioned the Eras Tour, which is the highest grossing music tour in history, which rendered Taylor Swift a billionaire, one of very few musical artists ever to hit that mark, especially from mostly just music rather than some sort of side hustles. And this is her fourth album in as many years of original studio material, and add on top of that the concert film and live albums, and this incredible sort of fire hose of Taylor Swift material. And I think, you know, I think there's a lot of interesting and moving and clever and funny stuff on this album, but I think that it's very difficult not to feel a certain amount of Taylor fatigue at this point. And I think the mixed reactions to the record reflect that. I actually think it's a better album than Midnights, which, you know, I didn't really know how to register at first. And looking back, I think is one of her weaker efforts. And this album, I think, is much more memorable and has a lot more going on, but it's not a simple, well-contained, well-crafted statement. It's sort of a messy, dripping, overflowing one.
As the closest thing to a Taylor fan on the show, and I am a Taylor fan, I had a response to it that I would be curious for your thoughts on, Carl, which is, I can't decide if this is a manic album, like the frenetic overproduction of Taylor in the last 5 years. It's too much. Like, I was not excited to listen to this album. I don't need more Taylor. I could take a break. Like, give me a year. You know, go have fun with Travis. Come back later. There's that line from Never Ever Getting Back Together about it being exhausting. Like, at this point, the Taylor is exhausting. And I really like her music. And I really like a lot of the songs and lyrics on this. It's hard to even call it an album. Double album, anthology, glut of songs. I mean, even just like watching her for the last year, you're like, when did you do this? Literally, when were you in the studio doing this? You were in studio every day. You were apparently ending a major love affair, conducting a brief torrid one that really wrecked you, apparently, and then falling in love with the guy who won the Super Bowl. Like, this is too much stuff. Like, when did you do this? So I can't decide if it's either like a manic sign that she's so accustomed to a high bandwidth lifestyle that she doesn't realize she could take a beat, and she's a little bit out of control of her production and her output and her ability to hit her mark, which she's usually so on top of. Or is this just as calculated as Taylor ever is, and it's a calculated choice to do something kind of messy and sloppy and underbaked because everything has been so precise and precision machine for the last couple of years, and to just kind of come out too fast with something that's swerving all over the place, just to almost like lance the boil of pressure for her to be perfect all the time? And I think I'm leaning slightly towards camp two, but I'm curious whether that question arose for you too in your listening.
Yeah, it very much did. I think what I feel is that on the one hand, this is the product of somebody who is at the very top of their field in such a way that there is no one, there are no possible naysayers. There is no one to stand in her way. She's still working with Aaron Dessner and Jack Antonoff, the two producers she's been working on through all of these four albums. And so they're in whatever kind of routine that they are in, which I suspect often consists of her having ideas, them generating some basic music material for her to work over. And then if you've seen the Miss Americana documentary, you see the way that there's kind of just a jamming process in the studio where a lot of stuff comes off the top of her head and is kind of brainstorming based. And a lot of the songs on this album feel like that to me. I know I said that it in some ways feels like kind of a video game where Taylor's the other player and you're just constantly getting this barrage of commentary from her. And someone else commented, which I thought was very accurate in a way that it also feels like a podcast. It feels like a 2-hour podcast where it was kind of rambling and there just happens to be music going on. And so there's all of that formlessness which is distressing and, you know, makes one hearken back to the days of Red in 1989 when her songs were sort of carefully crafted and formed. But there is also something sort of postmodern and participatory and experimental in this way of creating kind of a narrative arc about this breakup and this rebound relationship, and then her reflections on sort of fame and her rivalries, and at one point definitely in But Daddy I Love Him, like pushing back against her family and her fans and other people who have opinions about how she should conduct her personal life. And all of that is really fascinating. And in some ways, my initial reaction, which was to lament the bagginess of it, feels like too conservative a way. And so does the psychoanalyzing of she doesn't know what she's doing. She's out of control. She's manic. You know, again, Taylor Swift, control freak. There's no way to think that she hasn't thought about all of these things herself. But whether it's art, I feel like I need probably some months to come to a settled opinion on whether it all works. And, you know, at this point, where the fear is that by that point, there'll be, you know, 30 more songs to deal with.
Four more.
Can we listen a little bit to Daddy I Love Him? Because I think that's emerging as my favorite song so far.
Yeah, Carl, I experienced this album in a way that I almost never do with the new form of I am dramatically dropping music at midnight. I very rarely am sitting there breathlessly waiting for the music because, unlike you, I don't have to stay up all night writing about it. But I happened to be traveling and in a hotel room and unable to sleep because I was on, you know, different hours, and saw that the new Taylor Swift album was out. So I just got in the bathtub, took a bath, and listened to the whole album. This was before the 15 bonus track dump. So I'm really just responding mainly to the stuff that came on the original album release. And I was sort of looking forward to it being this nice immersion in, you know, pleasant pop Taylor-ness. And I found myself feeling really sad and bad. It's not even that I hate the album or don't enjoy some of the songs on it, but I've talked before on the show how I think my feeling toward Taylor is a little bit maternal, maybe because I started listening to her when my daughter was really young and Taylor was really young, was still a teenager writing songs. And I always have this feeling about her, like, well, how nice for her. She's handling her fame well, you know, or isn't it great that she's, you know, experiencing success for her creativity? It's this kind of maybe condescending, but like affectionate feeling toward her that doesn't quite go as far as like I would go see her in concert. But when I saw the Eras movie, for example, it was sort of like, look how our girl has grown up and how wonderfully she's doing for herself. Then I hear this album, and honestly, it sounds to me, again, being condescending and maternal, a little bit like a cry for help. Mm-hmm. There's that song, I Can Do It With a Broken Heart, right? And it's one of the catchier songs on the record.
She's having the time of her life. There in her glittering prime.
The whole joke of which is, I'm so miserable and depressed, but I can get up on stage and sing for tens of thousands of people. The chorus is something like, I'm grinning like I'm winning. I was hitting my marks.
The crowd was chanting more. I was grinning like I'm winning. I was hitting my marks. Cause I can do it with a broken heart.
And she talks about being this kind of trained performer. And this relates, I think, to what Julia was just saying about it being sort of strange that she's coming out with this excessive album dump right now, right after the end of this Eras Tour year in which she was on everybody's lips constantly and made $1 billion and toured the world. And this kind of need to immediately dump a giant album that isn't significantly different in content from some of her far earlier albums, right, with the boyfriend diss tracks and the heartbreak and everything extremely focused on her romantic life. Obviously, that's what a huge number of pop songs are about. And I'm not saying you can't write a pop song about your romantic life, but something about the inwardness of this album mm-hmm. combined with the excess that you're talking about. And then these cry for help tracks where she seems to be saying, like, I'm actually really suffering here, made me feel kind of worried about her and feel like what Julia was saying about take some time and have fun with Travis Kelce and let your next album cook also just kind of goes to just wellness and mental health. Like, right. You don't need to be reinscribing your famousness right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Dana, you've put your finger on why I actually kind of like this music way more than I've liked anything else she's done. There's a tiny bit of recognizable human sadness and maturity on display here, coming out of exactly what you're pointing to, which is this discrepancy between her world-conquering triumphs as a result of what are clearly an iron will and an urge to control all inputs and therefore achieve all, you know, maximalist outputs, and the loss of control inherent in falling in love, losing a serious relationship, being humiliated in what was a short one, but apparently not frivolous one. But almost more than that, it's just the gigantism of being Taylor Swift can't correspond to anything real about being Taylor Swift. At the end of the day, we are finite creatures embedded in time and a single human lifespan seeking a few pretty elemental things. And you can't, like, the Jumbotron can only get so big in relation to an ordinary human being experiencing ordinary human emotions. And I think it's that crazy discrepancy of scale that she has to live every single day. I mean, that actually are becoming a weirdly fertile muse for her in a sense. It's something, Carl, to me, I hear something here beyond the usual coy peekaboo of Taylor Swift, right? Like, she knows we've read the gossip pages that feature her, and she's going to use that as grist. And then she's going to punish us for taking a prurient interest or censorious interest in her personal life.
But she's been doing that since Reputation, at least.
No, I understand that. I'm saying that there's something more audible here to a listener like me. I mean, for one thing, the opening track, Fortnite, which I really, really like, she sounds like Lana Del Rey. I mean, you cannot tell me I'm wrong that the influence of Lana Del Rey has worked its way into that song. So there's this confusion and out of, you know, like she has the chaos by which you give birth to a dancing star.
I mean, it sounds like you love the reasons for the exact same reasons that I don't like it. And then Julia seems
I like it for all the reasons most people are like, eh.
That's so interesting, Steve, because, you know, obviously she's had public songs about paramours in the past. I think what is happening on this album that's interesting as you go through it is that some of those tics feel immature. Like, how much did Matty Healy really wreck you? And then some of them feel like security blankets almost. Like maybe a way to read it is that this thing she's dealing with now, just the juggernaut of her selfhood and her business, and all this, and her sparkling summer, is kind of overwhelming. And so she's halfway on the album finding a security blanket in complaint songs about bad men. I tend to like the ones that are about her own, exploring her own proclivities and propensities. There's a song on the late set of tracks called The Bolter about her friend's fond sense of her as someone who ditches the men in her life that is, I think, going to be an enduring one on my playlists, in addition to the ones that we've played so far. But there's this tension between the old security blanket of being the victim of some man or some situation, and then this kind of new, more prickly, what's it actually like to be this famous, which it's always difficult. It's always like a bummer when the artist gets to the My Problems Are Now How Famous I Am album. Like, that's usually not a good album. But the kind of tension between whether she's really embracing that or leaning on these older tropes is maybe part of what makes this interesting to keep listening to, even if it doesn't dazzle and seems like too much on first go.
Julia, I think that's exactly right. You know, I discussed this a lot in my review in Slate, that part of what's happening with the sort of Matty Healy storyline, to be honest, you know, I don't doubt that there are real feelings. Also, you know, it's very surprising that this material about a relatively short, possibly longer than publicly we were given to think, but still a relatively short relationship, overwhelms the narrative that's about a 6-year relationship, the longest relationship of her life, probably, you know, almost certainly the most significant and adult relationship in her life. And she manages in a few songs like So Long London and the first of the bonus tracks, The Black Dog, which I really love. She manages in some places to capture the really placing sadness of a relationship disintegrating in that way. But in a lot of the album, it feels like she reaches for that other material because it's familiar ground for her, because she can do that Taylor Swift thing. She makes a remark at the beginning of the liner notes to this album about the poet smirks to herself because it's the worst men that I write best. And you can see her kind of going to her comfort zone in that way. And it feels like a bit of a regression in some ways compared to some of the writing on Folklore and Evermore, for example. And that's emotionally understandable. But the interesting thing about dealing with the fame problem is, you know, I think Do It With a Broken Heart is in some ways the most relatable song on the album, because it's about, you know, it's about having to carry on through heartbreak, you know, and live your life and do, and, you know, we've all seen the weird thing that she does for a living, and she knows that we've seen it. And so she's kind of lifting the curtain back figuratively and saying, this is what was really going on while you were watching me do all that. And I think that we can all understand that emotional dynamic. And that's, you know, it reminds me a bit of Dancing on My Own by Robin. It's that perfect kind of example of the upbeat and incredibly depressive in sync. And of course, that's also the subject of the song. So I think that there are moments of sort of real self-knowledge and sophistication here, battling with those old instincts to find somebody to be the victim of and then be able to righteously complain about in ways that do feel like retreading ground. That's all interesting in a way, and probably an accurate portrayal of the in-between space that she finds herself in. And I liked to hear that Steve thinks there's signs of a maturing voice in that, and I hope so too. But I do kind of hope that maturity comes into full blossom. I always feel with Taylor, you know, less a parental regard and more this hyper awareness of the fact that she comes out of this sort of adolescent child stardom experience, which I think has really deep psychological ramifications for any artist who goes through that. And I think we're still watching, you know, a 34-year-old struggling to become themselves and move forward rather than be arrested in her development in that way. And you can definitely feel the drama and dynamism of that struggle in this album.
I hope so, Carl. All I can say is that hearing that song, to which the chorus is, I pretend it's my birthday every day. I'm so depressed, I act like it's my birthday every day. A part of me wants to say, honey, you don't have to do that. Your art would actually be better if you stopped pretending it was your birthday and took a moment to be sad.
All right. Well, Carl, as always, a total pleasure talking to you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, everybody.
All right, well, spring is here, so it is time to say goodbye to our heavy jackets and sweaters and coats, and hello to shorts and t-shirts. If you want to update your wardrobe for the spring without spending a fortune, look at Quince. With Quince, you can get a lineup of timeless pieces that keep you looking effortlessly chic year after year. I have two of their items. I've gotten one more thing from Quince since we last spoke, and it's this silk lilac skirt, sort of like a grayish lilac, really muted color, one of my favorite kind of shades that you don't often see in clothes. And it's very springy. So I am thinking now about what to pair it with. Skirts are kind of tricky. You have to figure out like the right top that is the right waistline and the right shoes. But I'm really excited to plan some outfits around my Quince silk lilac skirt. All right, you two listeners can get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/culture for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/culture to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/culture. This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Let's face it, sometimes multitasking can be overwhelming. Like when your favorite podcast, ours, is playing and the person next to you is talking and your car fan is blasting, all while you're trying to find the perfect parking spot. But then again, sometimes multitasking is easy, like quoting with Progressive Insurance. They do the hard work of comparing rates so you can find a great rate that works for you, even if it's not with them. Give their nifty comparison tool a try, and you might just find getting the rate and coverage you deserve is easy. All you need to do is visit Progressive's website to get a quote with all the coverages you want, like comprehensive and collision coverage or personal injury protection. Then you'll see Progressive's direct rate, And their tool will provide options from other companies, all lined up and ready to compare, so it's simple to choose the rate and coverages you like. Press play on comparing auto rates. Quote at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
All right, now is the moment in our podcast where we discuss business. Dana, what do we have this week?
Stephen, our sole item of business this week is to tell you about today's Slate Plus segment. Today's Slate Plus segment is a kind of continuation, part two, of the Slate Plus we did 2 weeks ago, last time I was here on the show, which was about our relationship to ambition. A listener wrote in to ask, what is our relationship to ambition in our lives versus contentment? The desire to build a happy personal life versus the idea to achieve things in your career. It's a great question, one that we're all at a moment of rethinking, I think, in different ways, Julia especially, with her career change right now. And that discussion ended on a question we didn't have time to get into, but we want to today, which is ambition for your children. A very different and in a way more emotionally complicated question. How do you balance what you want for them with what they want for themselves? How do you pass along a sense of giving them some drive without making them feel driven? It's a really big, wide open question. And Steve, you and I, especially having kids that are leaving for college, I think it's a great one to consider right now. All right, onward.
Fallout was an iconic video game franchise. It goes back to the late 90s, known for its retro futurist kitschy look and feel and its immersive world building. It's now been adapted to a TV show, into a TV show on Amazon Prime. The main storyline here involves Lucy, who has known nothing but the vault that she grew up in, a sort of subterranean nuclear bunker into which a few lucky human communities have managed to survive a nuclear apocalypse, with no idea really what now lies hundreds of years after that apocalypse on the surface of the Earth. Lucy must now come to the surface and go on a quest. The show stars Ella Purnell as Lucy and Kyle MacLachlan as her father. There's also Walton Goggins as a mysterious cowboy ghoul. In the clip we're about to hear, Lucy, in search of her father, asks an old woman from the wasteland about the bandit who has captured him.
Get out of here, Vault Dweller.
Ma'am, this Moldaver broke into my vault, took my dad, and killed...
And I'm telling you, you're going to go through a whole lot worse if you stay around here. Trust me. I can tell by looking at you. Clean hair, nice teeth. All 10 fingers. Must be nice.
Well, I know that it can't have been easy for you, but the mission of the vaults should be important to everyone.
And why is that?
Well, you see, the idea is that we're going to save America.
And when exactly were you planning on saving America? The vaults were nothing more than a hole in the ground for rich folks to hide in while the rest of the world burned.
Dana, let me start with you. It's been argued that now that Marvel and Star Wars are starting to wheeze out, the Hollywood factory needs some IP to work with, and video games, which, you know, given The Last of Us and various others, have been a, you know, productive source of material, but they may become a more primary source of material going forward. This is obviously a big installment in that possibility. What do you make of the show?
Yeah, Steve, you're not going to get a very in-depth critical response from me on this one because I only watched 2 episodes of Fallout. That was all I could take. I think this show does not work at all. Unlike The Last of Us, I just don't think that it makes the jump from the video game world to the TV world in a way that creates a story with characters that I care about. I gather that one of the big points of the game, the video game Fallout, is the very elaborate world building, that it takes place in this post-apocalypse world, but it's a post-apocalypse of a different America than the one we live in, one where sort of 50s style, I don't know, nostalgic futurism or sort of space age, you know, optimism prevailed right up until the moment the bombs dropped. And we see that moment at the beginning of the show. And so there's all this kind of funky design in the background, which I think if you're in the game itself is probably the way that you explore that world, right? So you could pick up an object and look at it and read about it, and that's what people enjoy when playing the game. But all it came off as, all of this world building in the show to me, was just decorative clutter in front of a lot of really uninteresting characters blowing each other away. and saying snarky lines at the same time. I could barely make myself watch it. I thought it was terrible. And one of the most annoying ticks about it to me, which seems to be something that's being admired in a lot of the writing about it, was the use of these kind of retro 50s needle drops, so that there's scene after scene after scene of gory, violent things happening in an apocalyptic wasteland while like Nat King Cole is singing or the Ink Spots. Right. And like, we get it. Martin Scorsese has done that for decades, that kind of like ironic matching of music with violence in a scene. But he doesn't just only do that over and over and over, making the same exact point with the music. And it drove me crazy.
So Dana liked it. But Julia, what'd you think?
Well, I definitely liked it a lot more than Dana did. I was interested in it. It's striking how much the plot is comparable to The Last of Us, right? We find ourselves in a post-apocalyptic America. There's a, you know, present day prologue and then a cut to the later and the strange rules and, you know, what does everything look like? Part of the fun of it are the reveals of the production design. But where The Last of Us is grounded in a kind of realism, like it's a tense, taut psychological realism, you know, plus or minus some mushrooms. This, the aesthetics of this show are confounding at first and then intriguing to me. You know, Jonathan Nolan, you know, who along with his partners behind Westworld is the architect of this project. His bona fides are quite strong. He's not an amateur. And I found myself puzzling over the look and feel of the show and his auspices and trying to think through what it's doing. Because in addition to having this retrofuturist aesthetic, which is kind of intriguing around every corner to look at, it also has, like I was trying to figure out why so many scenes looked like Buffy. Like it looks cheap. It looks extremely expensive and cheap at the same time. And I was like, why does this look so ticky-tack? And then I was like, oh, it's trying to distinguish itself from Marvel by leaning on the aesthetic of B-movies from the 50s, I think. Like, I think that's why the monsters look like they do. It's not because they couldn't make a less disgusting and rubbery-looking axolotl. It's because they decided to make a disgusting and rubbery-looking axolotl that you know, attacks them for a nuclear head or whatever. The reason that the axolotl looks rubbery and fake is not because Jonathan Nolan doesn't know how to make an axolotl that looks different, I don't think. I think it's a choice, and it gives the whole show this aesthetic of like camp, lurid shtick, which is maybe not my flavor, but especially compared with the taut psychological realism of The Last of Us, which I also didn't finish because I don't really want to watch shows where I get scared all the time. And this one is maybe less scary, but more bloody in gratuitous ways that aren't my cup of tea. But I found a lot to admire in it. And I actually did find the characters and the problems intriguing. Like, you know, it's the what if of the world building is pretty fun to explore, I thought. Steve, break the tie.
Oh, Team Dana. I mean, I got to the end of episode two just, you know, filled with ennui, you know, just a horrible television-hating ennui. Well, first of all, you have to create something that works for people who've never played the game. I mean, I would think, you know what I mean? I understand that video games are huge, and a built-in audience that's just going to watch this initially is mammoth enough to kickstart it commercially. But to have real legs, you know, you have to assume on a part of the audience unfamiliarity with the original or indifference to the original, which I qualify for. I mean, I just never played it. And therefore, world building in a fictional sense versus world building in a video game context strike me as two entirely different exercises, because you have control and volition in the latter. And therefore, the expansiveness of the world in and of itself has a kind of wonderful, dizzying, you know, pleasurable, experiential feel to it. But of course, when you're sitting watching a story unfolding on a flat screen, you know, its sense of its depth and experiential relevance has to come from something tied much more to characterization and plot. And those were so, to me, attenuated here. I was just like, I saw how playing it would be fun. I wanted to explore the world with a little joystick or a thumb button or whatever the hell they're called. But following these actual people through this world to me was just completely enervating. I think the oddity of the gore, having that much gore, Julia, as you indicate, but lacking any suspense was very weird to me. It seemed unreal in the way video game violence is unreal. It has to be somewhat, I mean, it has to be graphic and yet at the same time kind of unreal in a cartoonish way in order for non-sociopaths to enjoy indulging
yeah,
in it.
Yeah, comic gore is hard to get away with. Like Sam Raimi can do comic gore. Right. There's a few people I've seen pull it off. But in this show, it really left me with a bad taste in my mouth. And, you know, I think that the design elements in the background, if they could be explored, would probably offer the depth that you and I feel is lacking in the surface of the show. In fact, our producer, Jared Downing, wrote on this show and on the video game for Slate and sort of said that part of the fun of the video game is that the world is so exciting and the characters are so bland and neutral that it kind of allows you to ignore the story part of it and just explore the world. And by its very nature, right, the TV screen doesn't quite allow you to do that. But I still could imagine a version of a TV show that would offer more sort of explanations of, you know, what do the cluttered signage in the background, like what is the lost world that it's pointing to? And maybe if I had the patience to stick with this show, I would learn more about some of that stuff. But I just don't care enough about this young woman making a pilgrimage through the wasteland.
Well, if you watch a bit more, actually, Dana, that does become some of the subject of the show, the sort of how did they get here? And, you know, we heard a little bit in the clip, I think one of the things I found most intriguing about the show, which is the various different subcultures that are built in the wasteland and built in the after, and how they conflict. You know, one of the other characters, and I think some of these scenes are maybe the least successful so far, but is this trainee that's part of a knighthood that's, you know, connected with medieval mores to try and right the world and has sort of a militaristic concept of valor that may or may not apply and is thwarted and perverted in all kinds of ways. You know, these seeing these different subcultures intersect to me was interesting. And I think you can either be overwhelmed by the extent of the world and the grotesqueness of the violence and the thinness of the characters in the first one. But if you stick with it, they do keep unfurling. And, you know, the audience for this show is pretty significant. It's been a substantial success for Amazon. And I think people are finding things to connect with in it. One thing that it made me think about in terms of the notion that we're headed into a world where video games are the founding IP rather than comic books. And I think, you know, I'm probably equally qualified or unqualified to pronounce on both as neither a big comic book fan nor a big video game fan, is that this show, even though it's probably not my, you know, most passionate cup of tea, made me excited about this transition, not just because I'm excited for it to be something new, but for some of the reasons that Jared hints at in his smart piece, and that others have commented on in coverage of this transition that Hollywood is making, which is both of these universes are somewhat unfamiliar to me. I was never a comic book person. I haven't been a big video game person apart from iPhone games. But with comics, what the ignorant person knows is the basics, right? You have a sense, there are these heroes, they fight evil, there might be a costume. It's the characters that you have some archetypal vibe for as the dumb-dumb audience. And with video games, if you're the dumb-dumb audience, you kind of know much less, right? And it tends to be less about the characters and more about the worlds because, at least in a lot of these games, you are the character, right, in a video game. And I was trying to think about whether it's better for the IP to be the characters around which worlds have to be built or worlds in which characters need to be installed. And I'm, I don't know, kind of excited for this shift towards expansive terrains to explore. And I also, I'm sorry, I do care about this little vaulty girl. She's hilarious. She looks like an anime character. This Ella Purnell's eyes are as large as the Atlantic Ocean. Like, what are they doing on her face? They're so big. And she's kind of got a great comedic dimwit performance going as this like plucky Girl Scout in the apocalypse. It's pretty funny. I totally enjoyed her performance.
I have nothing against the performances, and I always love to see Walton Goggins in anything. I just didn't find any of the laugh lines funny. I didn't, anybody could be picked off at any time by, you know, a robot suddenly appearing on the scene. I felt the video game translation to film, and I didn't feel that awkwardness with The Last of Us. You could have shown me that with me not knowing that it came from a video game. I mean, I wasn't as absolutely crazy about that show as some people were, with the exception of the Nick Offerman episode. But it didn't feel like that translation was apparent on the surface in the same way. I certainly don't want to be saying across the board all video game adaptations are bad, or this medium could never work on television, or only The Last of Us did it right. It does strike me that something different between this adaptation's approach and The Last of Us approach is that apparently in the game The Last of Us, the characters that we see on screen were the player characters in the game. Whereas what's happened here with Fallout is that the world of the game has been taken and entirely new characters and a new story have been created. In this particular case, I think The Last of Us approach worked better. But I do like the idea of maybe just sort of adapting a world and then thinking of what story to place in it. That might allow for a little bit more flexibility and keep the IP of video games from starting to feel like the way superhero movies have felt, that we're just locked into the same themes repeating and the same characters over and over.
But I mean, if nothing else, just almost as an entertainment business story, it's going to be fascinating because there's a, correct me if I'm wrong, a aura of crisis right now in Hollywood, a lack of commercial direction for the first time since 08 when Iron Man came out and Star Wars got seriously revived and Disney sort of hoovered up all the IP and turned it into a, you know, in many ways, a very efficient and super lucrative factory for new Hollywood films. And it feels as though that factory has kind of ground to a little bit of a halt. So it's just going to be interesting to see whether or not you can generate the same kind of built-in fan interest that makes something a low-risk, high-reward proposition. All right. Well, Fallout is based on the video game series. It's now a TV show on Amazon Prime. Seems to be a pretty huge hit. We were very divided on it. If you have an opinion, shoot us an email. Let us know what it is.
The chance of your being hurt by an atomic bomb is slight. But since there is a chance, you must know how to protect yourself. To protect yourself, you have to know what the bomb does.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season 2 of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Back in the 90s, Pepsi and Coca-Cola were in a heated race to try to win loyal customers by any means necessary. But when Pepsi launched an ambitious promotion that encouraged people to buy Pepsi and redeem points for prizes, they overlooked their own fine print in a major way. On each episode of Wondery's podcast, The Big Flop, comedians join host Misha Brown to chronicle one of the biggest pop culture fails of all time and try to answer the age-old question, who thought this was a good idea? Like, who at Pepsi thought it would be a good idea to advertise that people could earn enough points to redeem a military jet as a prize? When they launched their Pepsi points system, they never imagined somebody might try to actually snag it, but a 23-year-old did, and suddenly Pepsi owed him a jet. Follow The Big Flop on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Big Flop early and ad-free as you like now by joining Wondery Plus.
Becca Rothfeld is the book critic for The Washington Post, an editor at The Point, a contributing editor at The Boston Review, and a PhD candidate in philosophy at Harvard. Her new book, which is her first book, is All Things Are Too Small, Essays in Praise of Excess. It's being treated as a revelation by critics, in no small part, I think, because it cuts against some of the largest and most inexorable seeming, at least, trends in both criticism and mainstream culture. In criticism, the levying of exacting ethical judgment in the face of all cultural production, past and present. In mainstream culture, a kind of famished minimalism of Maria Kondo being the most obvious example, but Becca goes on to draw an analogy to much of contemporary fiction. Both instances are attempts to win control through divestiture of some kind. Becca, welcome to the program and congrats. The book really is a triumph. And I'm really curious to know, was this idea of maximalism
was it arrived at inductively, deductively, this kind of almost eros of maximalism that saturates the book? It must have some temperamental rhyme for your own sensibility. It obviously does. Talk a little bit about how you decided this was the book you wanted to begin with.
Yeah. So I definitely didn't come to my maximalism deductively. I think it's kind of not the thing that you could be persuaded of by rational argument. I certainly have always had a temperamental affinity for excess and a voracious appetite for art and food and pretty much everything else for which one can have an appetite. I decided to write this particular collection because I just kept noticing myself returning to the same themes in essays that I was writing over the course of several years. And some of those essays are collected in the book, some are omitted. But I realized that I kept thinking about the idea of gratuity, of having more than we need, and what is important about that. And so I decided to write an entire essay collection about it. And it was a delight to do. It was a delight to have the space to write really long essays, which is another way in which I'm a maximalist, I suppose.
Becca, a book full of essays is an especially hard thing to get across a sense of in a short podcast segment, because there's not really a through line. There is a through line that connects all of these essays together, which Steve just spoke about and you just spoke about. The idea of encouraging excess, abundance, and discouraging things like minimalism in housekeeping. You have an against Marie Kondo passage in your first essay, against mindfulness, which I thought was a really funny and beautiful part of the book that you talk about, you know, the sort of Zen meditation, empty mind ideal that we're all encouraged to work for that you reject. But you also spread the net really wide. You talk about sex as a form of body horror in the films of David Cronenberg. You talk about the phrase, have your cake and eat it too, which is a proverb that it took me decades to understand what it was even trying to say. I think I was in my 30s before I realized what people were saying when they said, have your cake and eat it too. I'm mentioning all these different topics just to give a sense of how wide-ranging your interests are. And something I really see and really appreciate about this book of essays is that your erudition to me feels digested. I don't have the feeling that you quickly read a book or an essay or watched a movie in order to say something about it in an essay. I have a feeling that, you know, somebody's life experience of, you know, looking at art and watching movies and reading and thinking about the world has been kind of, you know, fully crystallized into a series of arguments. And I'm curious, which, if any, of these essays was the spark for the whole thing? I mean, you say that you found that everything you thought about seemed to tie into this question of abundance versus minimalism. Was there one particular essay in here that was either the one that made you realize, I want to keep writing more about this, or the one that you said, I think I can use this as a seed for a book? And where does that occur? You know, did you plonk it right at the beginning, or is it buried somewhere in the book?
I think, bizarrely, it's actually my least favorite essay in the book, but it's the essay that got me started thinking about sort of the limits of egalitarianism, which is another theme of the book and makes me sound like a fascist. But what I mean is that there should be egalitarianism in the political and economic domain, but that we needn't import an ethic of egalitarianism into the cultural domain. We can say that artworks are better than others. Some artworks are better than others. We can have favorites. We can love one person and not love someone else. So the essay that got me started thinking about these themes and about the sort of contradictory directives in our culture surrounding them was the essay about Sally Rooney. I believe I have the distinction of being the first person to go public with my hatred of the novelist Sally Rooney. I wrote this review of her, I think it was in 2020. It feels like millennia ago because the intervening years are just a slush of nothingness. And the argument of the essay is that Sally Rooney's first two novels, I haven't read the subsequent novels, so maybe they're better on this front, kind of try to have it both ways. She has characters that she repeatedly describes as normal and unremarkable, but then in the same breath, she says that the characters are extraordinary. They're always getting the highest test score in the whole of their country. They're always publishing every short story that they set out to publish in the best literary magazine. Men are always falling in love with them. I think this is a contradiction at the heart of a lot of romance novels. So I liken Sally Rooney's novels to 50 Shades of Grey, perhaps a bit uncharitably, because I think in both, you have a character who is supposed to be at once completely normal and unaccomplished and an incredibly special person. And so I just started thinking about this tension, that this idea that everybody sort of wants to be no better than everybody else or be unostentatious in their virtuousness, and that they want to be nonetheless acknowledged as superior. And so that was just a I guess, a philosophical puzzle that got me started thinking about all these other kinds of inegalitarianism that are exciting.
One thing I'd be curious to hear you speak about, so the essay that wonderfully eviscerates the glut of decluttering advice that can be found on any bookstore shelf is marvelous, and your comparison between it and much contemporary fiction is really provocative. I had as someone who is susceptible to the idea that I should have less clutter, I feel like a lot of the minimalism that you're challenging with this series of essays itself feels to me like a response to not a voracious maximalism of pleasure and desire, but a stultifying, drowning landfill maximalism of like a culture full of stuff and nonsense and overwhelming stimulus. And maximalism is not the right word for it, but just like stuff everywhere, overwhelm, stimulus, chaos, madness. And so I'd be curious to hear how you puzzled through that dynamic.
Yeah, I tried throughout the essay collection, and I hope I succeeded in being kind of sympathetic to the impulses and predicaments that bring people to things like mindfulness and decluttering, even though I'm ultimately suspicious of those logics. So, and I don't say that nobody should ever meditate for a short period of time, or that nobody should ever throw things away in their house that they don't think should be in their house anymore. But I read for the essay a ton of decluttering books, and it seemed like there was an emergent logic or philosophy. The books repeat. Marie Kondo herself does not say this, but lots of other decluttering books do. I read most of the best-selling ones. They all say that you should keep what you need, not what you want. And so I think that that replicates a very instrumentalizing logic that is kind of at the heart of consumerism, that everything must be for something else, and that there is nothing that is defiant of the commodity structure. There are no things that we can value in their own right, not because they're useful or practical or because they confer some kind of quantifiable value, but just because they are luxuriously delightful. And that's why I think that the decluttering people are so hostile is not even the right word. They're so incapable of understanding why somebody would have art or why somebody would keep books in their house, because they're just not capable of understanding that there are different kinds of objects. There are objects that are not commodities that you accumulate to do something with, but just things that you love to have around you. So I think artworks are kind of a rebuke to consumerism in a way, because they're a weird kind of object. They're not fungible. You can't exchange artworks the way that you can exchange other kinds of commodities. And I think that that's something that's really left out of their picture. And similarly, the mindfulness people, like, I am a very anxious person, as all Jewish people are, I guess I would venture to say, and all writers are, I would also venture to say. But I think that the mindfulness solution goes beyond saying that you should just take a deep breath when you're in the midst of a panic attack. They also articulate this broader philosophy where what you should be trying to do in general is empty your mind of extraneous obsessions and fixations that might not be serving you well, that might not have any practical purpose in your life. And I think nonetheless, those are the things that make you who you are. They're valuable in their own right, regardless of whether they're for anything else.
Becca, I feel like there's a correct me if I'm wrong, like a rebuke to consumerism coming from the other angle too, from the maximalist angle, because your maximalism, which is an incredibly reductive term for a nuanced and sophisticated work like this, but it's not about satiety or possessing more in and of itself. It's kind of a superfluity of desire. There's, you know, as I said earlier, real sort of, you know, a sense of longing and yearning and not having are elemental to so much of what you're describing. And that comes out beautifully in one of my favorite essays, Ladies in Waiting, which I thought was wonderful for every reason. It's autobiographical. It has a genuine poignance to it. And it also revives Roland Barthes, who for me was so formative to my sense of reading and what an essay could be and what, I guess, you know, speaking loosely, theory might be. And he's just revived so beautifully in the context of the essay. Talk a little bit about waiting and what you brought to that word and to that concept.
Yeah, I wrote that. That was the earliest essay that I wrote. I wrote that when I was 25 or something. So it now seems very distant from me. Not that I'm so much older than 25. I'm 32, but it's a while ago. But I guess the book, it recognizes that we are afflicted by two kinds of smallness. One is culturally contingent. It's the product of a culturally contingent emphasis on shrinking ourselves and shrinking our possessions. The other, though, I think is endemic to the human condition, hence my interest in religious thinkers and mystics, which crops up throughout the collection, which is actually named for a poem by a medieval mystic. And this kind of smallness is just, we want more than we can ever have. We want more than our finite life allows us to access. We want more than one life. We want to live forever. We want to have closer contact with people that we love than we ever can because their lives are not our own. And so the essay about waiting, I think, is about this latter kind of smallness, as some of the other essays also are. It's about wanting more than your singular life could ever afford you, and feeling kind of truncated by your separation from the object of your love. And that is a kind of smallness, I guess, that in a way the book does celebrate. It celebrates that that smallness induces us to seek more. And maybe we can never get it on this earth. And that's why we turn to things like art, and medieval mystics turn to things like religion. But that's a kind of second discussion happening in the book.
Becca, I'm curious to hear you talk about how you bring yourself into the essays, your own personal history and your body and your relationships and your love life. This is not an I essay kind of book. It's not memoiristic, autobiographical essays. And none of the essays really take as their starting point your personal history. But there are several that weave in some very direct anecdotes from your own life and, you know, people that you've loved and experiences that you've had. And I wonder, just as an essayist and as somebody who clearly loves the form of the essay and reads a lot of essays, how you feel about the I, the personal voice entering into an essay, and how you tried to manage that as you were writing.
I think that there is a lot of hostility towards the I. There's kind of an assumption that a purely personal essay is necessarily self-indulgent, and I really resist that. But the reason I kind of appeal to my own experiences in my essays is that one of my frustrations with academic philosophy, and that's what my background is in, I was like 6 years into a PhD before I bailed to take a job at the Washington Post. Perhaps I'll write my dissertation someday. Who knows? But one of my frustrations with it is that it seemed like we were discussing all these issues that are obviously so important. They're so central to living a good life, and yet we were never applying them to our lives. It was purely an abstract exercise a lot of the time. And that's nobody's fault. Those are the norms of the discipline. And people would apply them to their lives sort of in private, but they wouldn't do that in their writing. And so one reason why I was motivated to write essays in this mode is because I kind of wish that more philosophy looked like this. I feel like this is the application of philosophy to living problems. And I've always thought of my life as fodder for philosophy. I think if you don't think that, if you don't think philosophy actually applies to your life and is relevant for you, you're not doing philosophy right. So it was always natural to me to try to test the theories that I have against my own experience, and also to use my own experience as evidence for philosophical theories, because I think that's an appropriate way to philosophize.
I love hearing your thoughts on that, because I do think that's part of what can be alienating about philosophy for those who don't pursue it as seriously as embarking on 6 years of a PhD, but dabble in it. And I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about applying that training in your new role at the Washington Post. It's been great having your voice in that forum. And as a recent newspaper employee myself, I'm curious what it's been like to be a philosopher in the body of a newspaper culture columnist. How is it applying that training in that realm?
I think that it's really fun because it's kind of unexpected. I mean, I think that the biggest thing that I've been able to do, which has surprised me a little bit, is just pick a really wider range of books to write about than I think other people might. I mean, other people might pick a different, equally wide range of books, but I get to pick much more philosophical books than I think might be typical for a weekly newspaper critic, which I think is great. I mean, I have this very optimistic, perhaps foolish belief that everybody is a philosopher. Philosophy is built into the way that we think about anything in our lives, and philosophy shouldn't be intimidating to people. And so I really think of it as my job as a public intellectual, insofar as that's what I am, to try to make philosophy friendly to people so that they feel comfortable to pick it up without dumbing it down or condescending to them, because I also have this optimistic belief that my readers are smart. They might just have been intimidated by academic sounding philosophy, because who wouldn't be? It's not written in an inviting way.
All right. Well, the book is All Things Are Too Small, Essays in Praise of Excess by Becca Rothfeld. Becca, you've written an extraordinary book. It really is a revival of a kind of criticism that I think hasn't been prevalent in recent decades. And I urge our listeners to go out and buy it. Becca, thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dear, oh dear, look at all this junk that fell out of that closet. We're going to go through that pile of whatnots and throw everything out we don't need.
Well, I've been through this stuff 100 times and there ain't a thing of it that I can spare.
Oh, there isn't.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on all your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City Branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
All right, now is the moment in our podcast when we endorse Dana. What do you have?
Steve, I was absent from the show last week because I was at Ebertfest in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, the annual Roger Ebert Film Festival in the town where he grew up and also went to college. It's a really special festival. This is not an endorsement for the festival, but I'm on my way to the thing I'm endorsing. But if anyone gets a chance out there and is interested, go to Ebertfest sometime. It's so sweet. It's not like any other festival. It's not industry at all. It's not about selling movies. There's some new movies, some old, but basically it's just a lovely community of filmgoers who all go to the same theater, beautiful old Art Deco movie palace, to see the same movies. There's no decisions to be made about I'm scurrying over here and I'll meet you after this. It's just movies and fellowship for a few days in the lovely town of Champaign-Urbana. So while I was there, I got conscripted to do some work that I hadn't initially thought I was doing. I came out to do a critic symposium with students at the University of Illinois. And because another critic hadn't shown up who was supposed to do Q&As after two movies, I wound up doing Q&As after two movies, one of which I had never seen. It's the least prepared I've ever been for a post-movie Q&A. It was see the movie, go up on stage immediately and interview the producer. But it's such a cozy fest that I didn't feel too nervous about being underprepared.
She's doing it live.
It was. I was so making it up as I went along. But the movie, the second movie that I did a Q&A after, it was so good. It was a movie that was up for the Best Foreign Film Oscar that we didn't see in the run up to the Oscars, and now I wish we had. It's called The Teacher's Lounge. It's a German film directed by a Turkish-German director named Ilker Çatak. I hope I'm saying his name right. I tried to look up the pronunciation. And The Teacher's Lounge, it's just extraordinary. It's a great movie about education. It doesn't really feel like any other movie about a teacher that I've seen, and I don't want to give away too much about it, but it's not a Dead Poets Society inspirational teacher movie, nor is it sort of, you know, this teacher is hiding dark secrets. It's much more ambivalent than that. It's the story of a middle school in Germany and a theft that occurs in the teacher's lounge. Somebody has their money stolen. And one of the teachers, who's the main character of the movie, sets out to figure out who is committing these thefts and who is being blamed for the thefts. And the whole thing turns into just this great sort of microcosm for a society. You might compare it in a way to Alexander Payne's Election, in that that is also a movie set in a school that turns it into a microcosm for society. But this isn't a satire. It's something different. It's almost like a psychological thriller. Anyway, everyone in the audience was spellbound. And you wouldn't think that a movie about, you know, somebody stealing money from a teacher's pocket at a middle school could be a pulse-pounding thriller. But Teacher's Lounge absolutely is. So seek it out. It's streaming in a bunch of places. I believe among those places are Amazon, Apple TV, and YouTube, but you can go out and easily find it right now because it was just up for an Oscar, The Teacher's Lounge.
That sounds amazing. I cannot wait to see it. Thank you, Dana. Julia, what do you have?
I actually have a recommendation that I have been holding in reserve until Dana came back to the show. And I'm curious, Dana, did anyone send you the Jumanji sketch from the recent Kristen Wiig episode of SNL?
No, no one did. Although I did hear that that was an unusually good recent episode of SNL, but tell me more.
It was a good episode, but this particular sketch stars Kristen Wiig as a woman who hates board games for a very strange reason.
Nina doesn't play board games. She's kind of freaked out by them.
Babe, you're making it sound like I'm afraid of board games. No, I'm not afraid of board games. I'm afraid of getting Jumanji'd.
And as you are our resident woman who hates games on boards and done through other mechanisms as well, And as I think of you as being a woman who really admires the comedic and acting chops of Kristen Wiig, I like loved this and watched this sketch 5 times, imagining you as the Kristen Wiig character.
You mean the fictional movie about a magical game?
Yeah, I mean, Jumanji is a movie. It isn't real.
You literally can't prove that.
So I feel both that our entire listenership should listen to this sketch if they have not, because it's one of the funniest SNL sketches I've seen in a while. And also that, Dana, you should enjoy it and possibly enact it.
You're not getting Jumanji.
No, I know I'm not getting Jumanji because I will not put myself in a position to be Jumanji.
I didn't think it was possible, but my daughter introduced me to yet another band that I've never heard of that, in fact, has been around for a decade or more. And I love their music, and I'm so into it. And I wonder if you guys have heard of them. They are called Jungle. You guys know Jungle?
Not at all.
So, Julia, I think this will intrigue you, is that if you put Krongbin, or whatever, how do you pronounce their name?
Krongbin.
When you put Krongbin in your Spotify, like, you know, make a radio station from this band, Jungle comes up. So it's in that same vein in a way. It's just got an incredible groove. I mean, it's described on Wiki. I know very little about them, as a British dance music project founded by London-based producers in 2013. It's just super groovy music. They're obviously employing like a ton of different talents and vocalists and on and on and on. I'll just give you the name of like starter cuts here. Back on 74, All of Time, Dominoes, Cherry. All of these are great. I just love them. I've been playing it on like on loop. Anyway, I love this music. And if people know it, talk to me about it. I hope you're digging it too. Julia, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Dana, thanks a lot.
It was fun, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com. Our introductory music is by the composer Nicholas Patel. Our production assistant is Kat Hong. Our producer is Jared Downing. For Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you soon.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.